The eagle has landed.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade.
Ask not what your country can do for you.
I consider myself the luckiest man.
I have a dream today.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Hello, welcome to Speaking of History, the podcast that has a focus on education, technology, and history. My name is Eric Langhorst. I'm an 8th grade American history teacher in Liberty, Missouri. You're listening to podcast episode number 124, and I'm doing the editing on December 8th, 2007. But today's podcast is actually a recording of the session that I did on November 30th in San Diego at the NCSS conference, and the title of my presentation was Why My Classroom is Web 2.0. So here's the audio from the entire presentation. It is about 50 minutes long, and this is also available on the blog as a Ustream video that was Ustreamed from the actual room there in San Diego. So here's the presentation from NCSS 2007 in San Diego, Why My Classroom is Web 2.0.
All right, well, I have a quarter till, so we'll go ahead and get started. And if somebody comes in, they can go ahead and join us. I did put some handouts on the back table, so if you would like a copy of today's presentation as a PowerPoint handout, that's available. Also, I'm going to be recording this, so depending a little bit on how late dinner goes tonight, it could be up on the podcast tonight or tomorrow morning. So if you wanted to share with somebody or listen to it again, it'll be up on the internet for you. Also, this is available as a PDF on the blog that I've been talking about under today's post. So if you run out of copies of that, I hope you will. You can get it there in the future and come back and look at it. Well, my name is Eric Langhorst. I'm an 8th grade American history teacher in Liberty, Missouri, which is a suburb just outside of Kansas City. I teach in a building with 8th and 9th graders, and I teach 6 sections of 8th graders during the day. And then I also teach a graduate course at Park University. I teach a graduate course entitled Technology for the Classroom, and we teach that as an online class in the wintertime. So like right now we're in week 6 of an 8-week course, and then I also teach as a face-to-face class in the spring at Park University on campus at Parkville, Missouri. Well, today I'm going to talk to you a little bit about Web 2.0 and how it looks in my classroom, my 8th grade American classroom. I've taught in a variety of classes. I teach in a very small town where I was the only social ed teacher, so I had everything from 7 to 12. And then now I teach in a larger district where I'm able to teach just one prep. But the things I'm going to talk about today, I think you can incorporate in basically any social studies classroom. I'm going to talk about tools that are free and available. There's only one thing that I'm going to talk about today that actually costs anything as far as like a subscription or anything or software. So these are things that you can incorporate into your classrooms for nothing. Okay? As long as you have a computer and internet connection, you'll be able to do these things as well. When I started teaching 14 years ago, I used an overhead projector where I wrote everything down on plastic and had the vis-a-vis permanently embedded in my hand all the time. And I thought I was really up to date because if I wanted to change something, you know, I could erase it with Windex and add something. And so that's how I started teaching. And what I'm going to talk about today is in a gradual process. It's not like I started to do all these things last year. So you know, maybe one of these things is something you'd like to try, or maybe some of you guys are doing some of these things. But this didn't just happen like in the last 6 months or anything. The question that I get a lot, because I'm kind of branded as like the technology guy in my district, is why should I teach my class different than I was taught? And I received an excellent education in high school, but basically the only methods that my teachers used were talking. We had to write stuff down. If you could spit it back out in 2 or 3 weeks on a piece of paper, you got a good grade. I'm going to talk first just a little bit about why I think we can improve on some of those methods and how I think that using some of the technology tools are more than just eye candy. It's something that fundamentally helps you teach history and engage students and prepare them for the 21st century. First reason, I think that Web 2.0 is just too powerful of a tool not to use. I can remember the first time I saw internet, it was in my second year of teaching, and basically, well, the first couple of years of the internet, I basically would go and maybe find a lesson plan or, you know, look up a news item or something like that. But for the most part, it was a one-way street. If you did not have the knowledge of HTML code, or you didn't have access to a server, you really couldn't contribute to the web. You could just pull stuff off. And that was a big thing. But today, with Web 2.0, it's much more of a two-way street. Anybody can publish content, whether it's video, audio, you know, kids are putting stuff on YouTube, you can do podcasts, video content, all kinds of different types of applications. So now it's much more of a two-way street. And our students are already there. I mean, they're already going home and posting stuff on these social networks and things. So I think it's a powerful tool that we can use and engage in. All you have to be able to do to use a blog today is basically be able to use Word or any type of word processor, and you can have a blog up in a matter of 5 minutes. So that's the first reason why I think we should really think about using these tools. Second one, the potential to reach more students with various learning styles. Each year I do a learning styles inventory with my students, and I found that kind of consistently over the last 5 or 6 years, about half of my students tend to be mostly kinesthetic learners, about a quarter tend to be auditory, and about a quarter tend to be visual. Well, in the classroom that I grew up in, if you were a visual learner, you were in pretty good shape. But if you were mainly a visual learner, or mainly kinesthetic, then you had to adjust your learning style to the teacher style if you wanted to get a good grade. So I've tried to incorporate some of these tools to allow students with different learning styles to be able to succeed and to be able to get the content and show me what they know as far as the content in various ways. Three, I think that access to information has definitely changed. I can remember driving to a larger town, I grew up in a town of 600 people, driving to a large town of 5,000 people to go to the library to do research for my term paper. It's no longer about getting access to information. It's about, okay, we got all this stuff. How are we going to actually use it? What do we use? Is it valid? Is it not valid? Those are the skills we really need to teach our students. Four, learning is now mobile, anywhere, anytime. How many people in here have taken an online class? Right? I mean, that's how I finished my master's degree, because I moved to another state, and so I was kind of stuck, and that's how I finished my master's degree. And I continually amazed when I teach my online class, you know, how much you can get out of that environment. You have to adapt, but the ability to log on in your pajamas at, you know, 11 o'clock at night is pretty cool. So, you know, making this stuff available to our kids through 12 students as well, not necessarily in a virtual schools environment, but just maybe as like an enhancement or another way that they can get contact. And then the last one, Web 2.0 can help reach those higher order thinking skills. You know, when you go into your administrator's office and you say, hey, I want to do this project with technology, you know, one of the first questions is, what is your outcome? What is your goal? Well, if our goals are things like, if our goals are things like improving discussion and getting them to create things, you know, more than just sit back information, we can use these tools to demonstrate that we're accomplishing those higher order thinking skills. So, my classroom that I'm in right now, we have an overhead data projector, and I have one computer in my classroom, which sits on my computer desk. We do have a document camera, which we just got, which I'm kind of finding out a little bit about. But my students are not in a one-to-one environment. I don't teach in that area yet. Hopefully, somewhere down the road, all my students will have laptops, but I'm still fighting for lab time with the English teacher and the science teacher like many of you are. So, as I'm talking about these things, most of them are enhancements. Not many of these things are required unless we can actually get to a lab and complete it in like 1 day or 2 days, something like that. So I don't have a one-on-one environment. Hopefully someday I will. So I'm going to talk today about how I'm trying to reach things with my students as far as increasing communication, discussion. We're going to talk about expert sources, simulations. It's not so much about the gadgets, although in some cases you might need to have a gadget or two. It's about how do we accomplish these outcomes. So, these are some of the things that I've been doing in my classroom that I think show that it's a successful tool. Collaboration. Last year I did some collaboration with a teacher in Australia. He contacted me and said, hey, I teach 8th grade Australian history. Would you be interested in doing some kind of podcast exchange? Because my kids are kind of into podcasting and I'm playing around a little bit. So we talked and we did some podcast exchange. His kids did some podcasts about what life was like in their school, what their town was like. He actually is in Bendigo, Australia. And my kids were at first, how will they understand our language now? Reason number one for global, you know, education. But we exchanged podcasts about what life is like in our towns and things. And then we also eventually want to kind of expand it. We have some like sketch ideas on how we'd like to do more history. And you might think, well, how, you know, how's 8th grade American history going to really correspond with 8th grade Australian history? Well, we both gained our independence from England. So right there you have, you know, compare and contrast, how did our quote-unquote revolutions or independence happen? There's also many, many issues you could talk about as far as settlement across our countries and how it affected the native peoples, you know, comparing how the Aborigines have been treated by the settlement in comparison to how the Native Americans in our continent have been treated by Western settlement. So, and then it was funny because when we had changed the podcast, my kids thought they had a heavy accent, and then my kids were stunned that the Australian students thought that we had heavy accents. These Midwestern students, you know. How can they not understand us? You know, they're the ones that sound like the crocodile hunter or whatever. So it's kind of funny how they thought about that. 2.5 years ago, I guess it was right at the end of the year, about 3 years ago, I bought a small MP3 player, and I bought it just because it was kind of a fun toy to have, kind of about this size. And I thought it was neat because I could attach it to my arm when I'm working out, or, you know, you know how you work out in your mind, well, I'll get this because it will help me exercise. You know? Well, it kind of does, but I haven't, like, become a marathon runner or anything because of it. But I started to do a podcast about 2.5 years ago, mainly to see if the technology would work. And it was just me talking into this little recorder about, you know, 5 minutes long, posted it on the web, and gradually, like, people started to listen to it. And the cool thing about having a podcast is it's kind of like having it on a radio show. You don't have to have a regularly scheduled radio show. You can talk about random things at random times, and if people want to listen, they can listen, and it's kind of just like having a digital journal. So I started this podcast called Speaking of History, talking about things I'm doing in my class or a book I just read that I thought was interesting. I take one of these little recorders along with me, so if I'm at a museum, I might ask the curator if he could tell me a little bit about the museum, record it, and then I can put it up on the podcast. I've done phone interviews now with some of the authors of books that I've read. So there's a variety of things that are contained in my podcast. It's very eclectic. I had a baby a month ago. I haven't done a lot of podcasting in the last month. But, you know, gradually I'll probably get into the flow, and I'll do some podcasting from the conference here. Just kind of a side note, this is, equipment-wise, this is an iRiver. I do have an iPod. I do like the iRiver, though, for recording, because it has an excellent internal microphone. You used to be able to buy these off the shelf at Best Buy. Best Buy's kind of shifted away from having this product on the shelf. So you'll need to get, it's called an iRiver. That's the brand name, it's iRiver. And this one's a, like the model is like T60 or something. But it runs on a AAA battery, okay? This is the whole thing right here. It's got an internal microphone, so if I wanted to interview somebody, I can just do the interview right here. It'll pick up both of our voices really well. You plug it in to your computer using just a little USB port, and it's just a drop and drag. It recognizes it just like a flash drive. You drop and drag the file, which is an MP3 file, and then you can edit it from there and just use it as it is. This was $70. It records about 50 hours of audio, and the battery lasts for about 40 hours. Okay? If you'd like to do something really cool for Christmas this year, get one of these, or just use a USB microphone. Talk to your parents, or talk to your family members about something in their life, and record it. I've already told my dad, I'm going to be out for like 3 hours this Christmas break. You know, we'll not watch one of the 8 Bowling Games or something. And well, I'm going to talk to you about how you meet mom. Okay? What was college like for you? My dad's a history teacher. My uncle's a history teacher. They said my grandfather dad in like 1978 did this with a big reel-to-reel recorder. They were both history teachers, and they thought it would be neat to record. My grandfather came from Germany in 1923. He fought in World War I as a German Marine. He came to Ellis Island, okay? I have that 6 hours of audio today. I was like 6 years old or something at the time. But I'm really glad they did that, because I have all that audio from my grandfather. I pulled it out the other day and I cried and I listened to it. So if you want to do something cool, record some family stories. These things are cheap. I'm doing a project with my students this spring where they're going to go home and record oral histories using these. They're pretty indestructible. I haven't had any problems with, you know, things breaking on them or anything like that. So anyway, I'm doing this podcast. I've had people from all over the world access the podcast. You can't really tell too well on this one, but this is in about a 2-month span recently this fall, and I got people in different countries, people emailing me from different places. I'm not showing this to you so you think, oh, this guy's really, you know, big time or whatever. This is me using $50 of equipment that I usually sit on my washing machine in my basement and talking to when my daughters and my wife go to sleep or something. Okay? It costs no money to do this. I'm using free software that's called Audacity that runs on Windows machines, Macs, or even Linux machines. If you don't want to use one of the portable devices like this, buy a $10 microphone at Walmart and plug it into your computer, or splurge a little bit and buy like a $30 USB microphone at Best Buy or something and record with that. You can find ways to host it for free. There's many places out there where you can host audio content. It doesn't cost you anything to house it. So that's kind of how we use podcasting. One of the recent things that I think has really worked on the podcast is I have a lot of teachers who listen to it. And I do this activity for the last several years. When we teach the Declaration of Independence, it's kind of hard to get eighth graders to really sometimes understand what the document actually did. So I do this little activity that's not related to technology, but they come into class and I pick up this piece of paper that I've put on the floor, I've planted it, drew little hearts on it and stuff like that. And I hold it up and I say, listen, I'm tired of you guys leaving your notes lying around, okay? I'm not going to pick all these up all the time for you. What I usually do is I read this to everybody, and then I embarrass the person really bad. I'm not going to do it today. I'm just warning you guys. And then several people beg me to read it, and I try it for a while, and then I finally read it, and it's a note, you know, and I'm going through it. It talks about how at one time we were really meant for each other. I actually used the term MFEO, and I pause. I have no idea what MFEO means. And then some kid goes, meant for each other. Duh. So I did this whole thing. We were made for each other. It was great. But you started to, you know, treat me differently lately. You started to really ignore me. You know, I don't really feel like we're connected anymore. I want to break up, and I believe it's your fault. And then I hold it up, and the kids are like, well, you got to tell us who it is. And one kid, usually in the back, somewhere goes, I know this couple. Every time I do this, I know this couple. So at the end, I hold it up, and then they beg me, I finally bring it out, and I say, it's signed, and there's just this huge pause. The American Colony. They're like, and then I go to the thing, they're like, whoa, what are you talking about? And then it all clicks. We get on our board, we go to the Declaration of Independence, and it's cool because they're like, because they never really look at it. When you tell them to look at it, but then after this activity, they're like, why does it say he? I'm like, that's the king. Okay? The whole Declaration of Independence is, I want to break up. You're to blame, and this is why. Boom, boom, boom. It's a long time. And so then it gets into it. So what I did this year, why I'm telling the story, is I put this on the corner of my desk for one of the classes, and I recorded it. So one of my podcasts from this fall is talking about this activity, then actually having the audio. And it's really cool to actually hear the kids and the venues and music and stuff. And I put that up on one of my podcasts. And like just 2 days ago, I had some email saying, oh, I did it in my class. It was awesome and stuff like that. So, but if you do that, and you have multiple sessions, we do this thing called the open secrecy, or we have something where it's like a surprise. And so they have to say this open, and they can't tell the other class, and they want everybody else to be punk like they were, so they usually don't tell anybody else. But anyway, so that's kind of how we use podcasts to collaborate. All right, anybody use Google Documents in here? Google Documents, very, very cool tool. How many times have you been in the lab and you got to have kids have a flash drive or save it to a disk, or they email their text that they're typing, you know, home so they can do it at home? As long as you have a Gmail account, which is free, to sign up for a Gmail account through Google, you can use basically an online application that's just like Word. But the cool thing about this is it saves automatically about every 5 seconds. So like say you work on something in class, your kids go home, they're at grandma's house, as long as they can log on the internet, they can continue to work on that project. The other neat thing is you can have as many people on there as you want. So you can tell five, you can allow it, the kids can create like 5 people have access to it. So those 5 people could all be at home working on the same document, or they could work on it separately. And then you as a teacher can also be one of the people that can see it, and the kids can set it up so you can either see it, or you can see it and add things to it. So if you wanted to add a comment, yeah, your conclusion was a little weak, you know, but you did a really good job on, you know, proving your points or something. But the other neat thing is you as a teacher can go in, and it's actually color-coded, so you can see what Billy wrote, what Sally wrote, so you can actually see, you know, if somebody's not contributed anything, that's in black and white right there, actually color on the screen. So you can also use the same application for basically Excel. You can do spreadsheets the same way, and they've just added basically a PowerPoint look-alike, which doesn't have quite as many doodads as PowerPoint, but you could have kids collaboratively do a PowerPoint on Google Docs. So it's really cool too.
Quick question. You said something about you have to have a Gmail account. So how do you have your kids all have those accounts?
Yeah.
So how do they get to work with each other?
We have our students all have email accounts set up through the school, but then for this, we also have them set up at home.
Okay.
So we had to look at check guys and say, you know, allow these guys to have permission in the labs and stuff at school so they can work on it and stuff. So we may have to work around how your IT people do that. But yeah, to be able to use Google Docs and stuff, you have to have your Gmail account to do it.
And
the
rule
says
that they actually have these extra accounts?
Most of them have accounts like that already. So our students have email accounts sponsored through the school for about 4 years now. So, it's not a huge sell, you know, for them, I guess. I mean, if they already have an outside email account anyway. So, I mean, it's what you, how you want to balance it, if it's something you'd like to use or not.
I was just going to say, you can also track changes in Word.
Yep.
You can track changes and it shows all the changes that were made in the document.
Yeah. And it's like, if you're like work with somebody, you like have to swap those Word documents back for them. I worked on a paper with Chrissy Keeler. She's a methods teacher at UNLV. We're doing a presentation tomorrow together. And we did this article together, and we did it on this. It was much easier than trying to constantly switch back versions of Word and stuff like that.
And just to follow up on the Google Docs thing, Google does offer a hosted apps for education solution as well, which is free for the base. So you can get all of your students in one location, so it's a little easier for them to collaborate documents out within that hosted apps domain, so to speak. It's kind of nice too. That just takes a little work to get
to configure it and stuff.
Yeah.
What is that called?
It's called just Google Hosted Apps for Education, or just look up Google
Education.
Education. So.
One of my favorite Web 2.0 projects is a project we did last year called the Book Blog Project. I found this book about 4 or 5 years ago called Guerrilla Season that talks about the beginning of the Civil War in Missouri. When I teach the Civil War in our locality, it's a lot different than the back east. We don't have these humongous battles like Gettysburg and things. We had terror on a daily basis with people going back and forth from the Kansas-Missouri border. We had guerrilla warfare constantly. People would come up on your farm and, you know, ask if you're, you know, Southern supporter or Union supporter, and then eventually they might burn their house down the next day. So this book described all that. I fell in love with the book. I wanted to use it with my students. We have about 300 students in 8th grade in my building. So the first thing I did was I wrote a grant to get a copy of the book for every student. But then the next problem was, how do we get 300 students to work on a project together? There's no way we can physically get them in one place. So I created a blog on Blogger, again, free. It takes about 5 minutes to create a blog. And I'm the moderator of the blog. And each week, there's like a suggested number of pages that the students read. And then there's like 3 or 4 discussion questions. And what we did was the students were then supposed to answer the question in the comments part of the blog. And I set it up so that all the comments would come to me first. So I'm the moderator of the blog. Nothing is posted until I see it and hit post. You can go in and set it up so that you can see all your comments, and you can read them right there and hit reject or publish. And then at first we allowed the students, we never allowed the students to use their first and last name. At first we said just log in as anonymous. But then what we found was, as you started to have discussions, you couldn't really build off of the discussion if everybody was anonymous. And so then we said, okay, think of a head name. So, you know, I'm Superman, and right now, you know, Billy Superman. Someone's the Pink Panther, you know, someone's Cinderella or whatever. So you could actually say, I really agree with what Superman said about Guerrilla Season being like Iraq, but I think there's also some other differences. So we allowed students to create these pen names. And then the blog was available, obviously, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We had parents read the book along with the students. So we made it so we had about 50 extra copies, gave those copies out to parents. We had our school board president read it. We had several community people read it. We had grandparents in other states reading it. And the coolest part of the project was we had the author, who lives in Philadelphia, join us. She was super excited about joining us on this project. And so the kids could literally ask the author questions on a daily basis about the book. I mean, how many times do you get kids reading a book and go, I wonder why the author had the person in this part of the book do that? You know, why didn't they do this? They could ask the author that question. She responded back on an almost daily basis for that month. And it did take a time commitment on her part, but she said that was one of the most amazing experiences she's ever had, of being able to correspond with students as they read the book. We had students reading a book with their mom and dad and then asking the author questions at home on the internet. We had several cases of grandparents reading, I had a girl say that my grandma called me when she finished the book, and she was crying and she was upset about how it ended. And they could talk about the book. A school board president was actually corresponding with the kids about what she thought of the book. So this did not kill the book. The students still went home and curled up on the couch with a cup of hot chocolate and stuff like that. It made the book come alive for them. And we're going to do this project again this next year. And anybody that would like to join us, we're going to do it probably in February. But if you want to join us, email me as soon as you can. My address is on the handout stuff. And just let me know. We've already got three or four people in California that are going to join us. Pat, who is the author in Philadelphia, is going to join us again. We've got several other people that have said they'd like to. We had people jump in from different parts of the world, just to look or to add comments. So it was a really neat experience. And as the blog began to get into the later stages, it became a showcase. So the students at the end of the project had to give me either like a poem written about the book and send it to me on an email, or they had to interview one of the characters in a fictional interview, or create a movie poster about the book, create a new a book cover, which was interesting because Pat, when it goes to paperback, she doesn't like the cover that much, so she wants a new idea. So I told the kids, she's looking for ideas, so, the kids actually felt like what they were, contributing might actually help her when she redesigns the book. So, yes, question?
Where did you say that
you posted the
blog?
On Blogger. Yep. I mean, it's free. It's easy to moderate the comments. It's easy to use. I don't think Google's going to go out of business anytime soon. They'll probably move a little before they go out of business. So,
Blogger.com or
Yeah, just blogger.com. Yep. I do have a really short little video that I created that kind of just describes it. It's about 4 minutes long. I'll play that real quick here for you. And this is created using Photo Story 3. So it's using digital still pictures, creating a video.
Kind of.
We only use it
One aspect of the curriculum of our teach is the Civil War, a portion of which was actually fought in our own community. Guerrilla Season is an historical novel by Pat Hughes, which describes the early years of the Civil War in Missouri as told through the eyes of two teenage boys, one, a young Jesse James, growing up in Clay County, Missouri in 1863. I wanted to incorporate the novel into our 8th grade American history classes here at South Valley Junior High with over 300 students. We wanted to include everyone, but a traditional book club was physically impossible. So I set up a blog to create a place where discussions about the book could take place 24/7. Over a 4-week time period in October of 2006, we discussed the book on the blog. I moderated all posts and comments. No names were used to protect student identities on the web. The author, Pat Hughes, joined us from her home in Philadelphia, answering student questions each day. Then, a class in California joined us, along with school board members, parents, grandparents, and a college professor in Louisiana. Each week, discussions focused on themes from that particular section of the novel. Opinions were shared, issues debated, and conversations were held with the author. The reading process was not linear this time. It was alive and evolving with the experiences of all those involved. As students began to turn in their final projects for the novel, the blog also became a showcase for their work. Audio interviews with characters, designing fictional movie posters, poems, and alternate endings. Students also learned more about Jesse James, a local historical figure, through videos that we watched from the History Channel and A&E. At the completion of the project, students completed a survey which revealed the success of the project. 93% of the students said that author participation in the blog made reading the book better. 79% of students said that they learned more about Missouri and the Civil War. And 84% of the students said that they wanted more projects using online technology. Since the completion of the book blog project, I've also witnessed an increase in student interest in the Civil War, and students have asked to participate in future blogging projects. Students also had several quotes about the project. Students said that they enjoyed sharing ideas and opinions with the author, and also hearing what other students around the world felt about the same book. Some students also felt that the blog gave them a unique way to be heard. The blog began to attract visitors from around the world. The USA Today featured the project in an article, and I was asked to write an article about the project for School Library Journal magazine. Various teachers have also emailed us with questions so that they can replicate the project in their own schools. This project would not have been possible without the high-speed internet provided by Time Warner, allowing us to post information on the blog and making it accessible to students. Our class also learned more about Jesse James by viewing videos from the History Channel and A&E. We have already made plans with author Pat Hughes to replicate the Gorilla Season Book Blog project next year, hopefully adding even more participants from various states. Technology in this project did not kill the traditional book, it enhanced it, making the reading experience more dynamic. Hard times are hard drives, using 21st century tools to teach the American Civil War.
All right, so that was created using Photo Story 3 with the Flink mic in a little bit, and then I narrated it and recorded it using Audacity, and then put it as the background music, and it's super easy to use. So. I did do an article for School Library Journal, so if anybody's interested in kind of the nuts and bolts and how it all was created and stuff, just do a Google search for the Dixie Clicks, and it'll show up. I've had a lot of people that have asked questions, and if they read that, it kind of answers a lot of the questions they have about the project. The podcast that I talked about is mainly a collaborative tool. I have some people that are homeschool students listen to it, or there's people like history, as you know me. But for the most part, it's not necessarily student-based. I mean, they can listen to it if they want. I did a little interview with the person that's the ranger, for example, like at Ford's Theater. So we're talking about the Lincoln assassination, we'll listen to that. But it's not really a student-based tool. The thing that we use with MP3 players that's really student-based is called a Steadicast. 3 years ago, I started to record an audio review for students as we got ready for our unit test. I just sit down with a microphone attached to a laptop, plug in Audacity, turn it on, start talking about what they need to know for the test, reviewing some of the major components and different things, just like I was sitting down with a student on an individual basis, helping them get ready. It takes about 20 minutes. I record it, and then I post it as an MP3 file to the internet, and then put the link on our classroom site. And then I put it in a little blog format so that it has an RSS feed so that you can get it off of iTunes as well. So my students at home can then click on that link and listen to it through their computer, or if they want to, they can go to iTunes and they just click on the podcast. It gets downloaded to their MP3 player or iPod, so they can buy something from Beyonce, then just download Mr. Lenore Studycast. It's completely free, it doesn't cost any money. The way most of my students listen to the Steadicast is just through the computer. But I have had students that have said that they like being able to listen to the Steadicast when they're walking a dog, riding the bus to school. I had a student earlier this year that was on a trip, and she was in the back of the plane using her iPod, and the stewardess was like, "What are you listening to?" And she was like, "My eighth grade registered teacher's Steadicast," and kind of embarrassed to say that. And the stewardess was like, "Well, it's actually kind of cool." So students are able to listen to it wherever they would like to. And we found that students that have learning disabilities have really found it to be beneficial because they can listen to it multiple times. There's no limit to how many times you can listen to it. I have some students that come and listen to it repeatedly before they go to bed, and it helps them go to sleep, which I don't really think. It's like, "Who's Lenny Morse?" I listen to it like 50 times, and I fall asleep to it, and then it plays while I'm sleeping, and I think it helps. I'm like, "Hey, if you think it helps, because you're listening to it when you fall asleep, but don't damage your ear because you're listening to the Steadicast when you're sleeping." But they're able to get their content and listen to it where they want to. And at first I thought, "Oh, it's kind of a novelty, we'll just kind of see how it works." The first year, we're in the spring, and I had something on the link wrong, and I had 5 parents email me the next day to test. "Mr. Langhorst, we'd really like to use that. Can you please check and see if the link is wrong?" So at that point I knew that it was something that students were using. And now students are bugging other teachers, "Hey, can you do a study cast like Mr. Langhorst does?" And so I've actually done some trainings with other people in our district, and we've got some elementary teachers who are doing stuff like this, other people at the middle grade level that are doing it. So it's been a pretty neat experience. And people are like, "Well, man, that sounds like a lot of time." Well, it only takes me 20 minutes to actually say what I'm saying. It takes me about 10 minutes to hit save and load it up to the internet. So I've invested a half an hour, and my students can now listen to it 1,000 times if they want to. So it does take a half an hour, but it's an amazing resource that can be replicated, over and over and over again. In our building, we actually do allow students to have MP3 players in the classroom. It's up to each individual teacher. 3 years ago, our policy was, if I see you in my fine class,
I'm going to take it. I'm going to take it out of the office. I'm going to write your name down on the magical pad. And if it's your first offense, you can pick it up at the end of the day. If it's your second offense, then we have to call your parents. If it's the third offense, your parents have to come in to pick it up. And so it was this huge paperwork thing. And, you know, I'm picking up some kid's MP3 player, and I'm responsible for it from my room to the office and stuff. So what we've done is we've said it's up to each individual teacher, just like gum. You know, you can have gum in your room if you want, or you can tell kids they can't have gum. So we do have times when we allow students to listen to their MP3 players. Every kid in our building does not have an iPod. Some kids have, you know, $30 MP3 players, or, you know, some don't have an MP3 player. But if you have one, at the end of like a math class, a teacher might allow you to listen to it while you're working. And what we found is, if they have their MP3 player on, they actually get a lot more done, because they're not focused on picking a little fight with the guy next to them or whatever. They're working on their stuff. And people are constantly saying, isn't that distracting? And I say, do you listen to a radio at work? Do you ever, do you listen to a, you know, you're driving, you're listening to the radio and talking. I mean, people can multitask, and we've also found it's a really good carrot. I mean, if you don't get your own friend, you've lost an iPod privilege if we have that. So our kids are not walking around 24 hours a day listening to their, you know, iPods, but teachers have found it to be something that we allow in school to use. So.
I haven't heard of anything about these. Can you archive your study tasks and you can use them in your teacher?
Yes, yes.
So you're 30-minute investment.
Right. Last week we had our unit 4 test. I didn't change anything, so I didn't even have to record anything. Okay. It was all right there. So,
yeah. Did you visit your school website?
I posted to our school server. We're in the free places, like there's a place called Our Archive. I'm not saying that right. Our Media, I'm sorry. Our Media, ORU Media. They host files for free. So there's places, as long as you don't have like tons of stuff, there's a lot of places where they'll allow you to upload stuff like a certain amount. So. We also, as far as like, again, talking about letting them create, which is that higher level thinking skill stuff. When we talk about the Boston Massacre, I allow my students to create a news program. We talk about what if the Boston Massacre would have happened today? How would CNN report it? How would the news be there, you know, right on the scene? We talk about how the Boston Massacre really wasn't a huge event, but it was made into a huge event because of the way it was, you know, made in propaganda, and the way it was, you know, reported by the Sons of Liberty and things like that. So I take three of my classes and I say, you're doing a news program from the London perspective. This would be like if London CNN was reporting this. The other three classes are doing it from the colonial perspective. You're going to interview people who are there. You're going to interview soldiers. If you're doing the London one, you're going to interview the king. You're going to interview people, you know, that, you know, like Paul Revere, things like that. And they create the scripts, they record it, and then they put little, you know, background music and stuff like that. Then the classes get to watch it from other classes. And we also then talk about how does media play a part in how you think about events happening today. War in Iraq would be a great example. We talk about, you know, because of what you watch on NBC or ABC, what's your perception of what's happening in Iraq, even though you're not an eyewitness person that's seeing what's happening on the ground. So we do that, it kind of brings in modern day media along with allowing them to create a colonial type of project. We also use Photo Story 3 for several projects. 2 weeks ago we did the Federalists and Anti-Federalists with the ratification of the Constitution. Not something that most eighth graders get really excited about and, you know, talk about it. But this year I said, okay, we're going to split up into groups of two, and you're going to create a TV ad that would have appeared to convince people to be Federalists, you know, to approve the Constitution. The other half are going to be people that are anti-Federalists. And then they create these little, you know, 60-second ads, and then you watch them in the class and stuff. And the students understood the concept of that time period better than they ever have in any time period that I've taught. So, you know, just doing a little thing like that, one class period in the lab, you know, they're creating a 60-second video, it's not like they're creating a, you know, a half an hour show or something. Very small, but they understand the concept, it's fun, it's something that's neat, and you can show it to them, things like that. We also have them create an 1860 Abraham Lincoln election ad. So again, to be able to create that election ad, you have to be able to understand the dynamics of, you know, what the issues of the day are, you know, lots of people running that year. You know, so you had to create an ad to help Lincoln become president. You have to, at some point in the video, or the commercial, they have to say, I'm Abraham Lincoln, I approve this message. But then again, you get to see other students work
And when they know that somebody else is going to see it besides just a teacher, then it becomes a much bigger thing. So it's kind of a neat project. And we also then talked about, could Abraham Lincoln be elected today? I mean, the guy's not the most photogenic guy. You know, he's not really probably smooth as far as the media, I would imagine. You know, could Abraham Lincoln be elected today? If not, think about that. Abraham Lincoln couldn't be elected today. What does that say about how we elect the president and how media looks and all that kind of stuff are portrayed? So, we also have had them do what we call Liberty Minutes projects, where they create a short 3 to 5 minute video about a local history project or a topic. We do a little Hollywood night, red carpet. We do it at an ice cream place. We give out little Oscar trophies. They think it's really cool. But the neatest thing about that is adults value what they've created. They presented their videos at a board meeting for the county archives. And when they saw that adults thought what they did was neat, it instantly, you know, raised the level of what they were doing. So, you know, creating, again, 3 to 5 minutes. You know, we're not asking them to do a half an hour thing. 3 to 5 minutes. I've had a web page for about 9 years or so, and for the first several years, I think I might have had two parents look at it. But now, since you know the internet is so a part of our lives, I really think that creating some type of web presence is a key for you as a teacher in communicating with your parents. We use Blackboard, but I've also used a blog. Again, Blogger, 5 minutes, it's free. Just post once a week what you're doing in class. All I do is I do a little, like, couple paragraphs, say, this is what we're doing, in a conversational tone, and then you can't see it on the screen, but then down below it, I say, Monday, this is what we're doing in class, and then the last line, homework. This day, that's what we do for homework. Tuesday, it takes me about, you know, 20 minutes maybe on Sunday night or Monday morning, but then I put it up on my website. I also collected their email addresses at the beginning of the year, and I also get a double shot to them, and I email it to them as well. And this has just dramatically decrease the number of phone calls that I don't know what to do with Tommy. You know, I ask him what the homework assignment is, he says it's done. I believe him, I don't have anything else to go off of. You know, it's a lot different conversation when you say, hey, did you get that, you know, American Revolutionary War project from Mr. Langlois then that's due on Friday? Other than just saying, do you have any homework tonight? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a way for them to feel like they know what's happening in class. I have a 4-year-old that's in a preschool situation. I pick her up every day. And if I just say, what'd you do today? I get nothing. But the teacher emails us each day, just a little thing. He said, this is what we did. We worked on the letter H. We watched The Grinch today. We made Christmas cookies, okay? So in the car, when I can go, hey, you watched The Grinch today? Oh, blah, blah. And then she doesn't stop for the next half hour. Mm-hmm. So just that little information really, really helps. And then that little homework thing, that eliminates a lot of problems too. So it doesn't have to be a Blackboard site, that, you know, a blog. This is what I'm doing in class this week. And it's a way for them to be able to look at it. But if you do that, it's got to be consistent. So I've had teachers before, they start it, and it's consistent for 2 or 3 weeks, and then it dies off. And once you've lost them, you've lost them. They're probably not going to come back if you don't update it on a regular basis. But again, maybe a half hour once a week would be a huge return on your investment in time.
Do you have kids that don't want to check? We've been posting your homework assignments on the web for several years now, and I have kids that don't want to check. So they come in, what do you do? I mean, so how do you, have you got any tricks done to get them to go, to keep checking and stuff?
Well, I mean, I say it's, you know, I'm not like, you know, I'm not going to tell you, but like, it's on the web.
It's
kind of ingrained now into the culture, and most other teachers that do it, so it's kind of just the accepted norm that that's where you go if you want to find out what you missed. So.
Okay. I didn't know if you had any tricks or anything.
Well, I mean,
to get people to keep checking.
Well, they don't
check.
If they don't check and they'll get handed in, they don't get graded, so I guess that's a carrot.
Yeah.
I have something. Every week I have something I call Picture of the Week. My system's called Edline. So on Edline I have the week's homework and the week's activities under the news section, but I also have a picture which has just a couple of very minimal research questions. So like Louisiana purchase, and then it might say when did it happen and what country did we purchase it from? And it's due every Thursday. And so every single week they have to visit that site to do that
as a reminder.
So it's been terrific.
Oh, that's a good idea to get them to go there. I mean, sometimes I'll do stuff like I'll like put a little extra credit thing on there and don't tell them about it, you know. So if they see it and they email me saying, oh, I saw this or whatever, And then they look and they check it for, you know, the next 3 days straight. Expert sources. Several years ago when we were talking about Jamestown, my students asked several questions I really know the answer to. So I emailed the people at Jamestown and said, hey, is it possible that maybe one of your archaeologists would answer some questions for us? And I convinced, you know, I told them, I'm not going to have like 150 students email you. I would go through the questions and maybe email you 5 or 10 questions. And they corresponded, and there's an archaeologist there named Ann Berry that said, sure, you know, that'd be fine. So several years ago, when we were studying Jamestown, it was right when a hurricane was hitting the coast of Virginia. And so it was right after the hurricane. The students asked questions about, you know, how do you preserve an archaeological site that's along a coast during a hurricane? Did anything get damaged, you know? So they asked some broad questions, and they also asked some very specific questions to something that happened just like 2 days before. And Anne emailed back, she said, sitting on her floor of her kitchen with a generator and her laptop, and she told us, you know, this is how they protected the site, and they did this, and, you know, only one of the buildings was damaged at all, and it didn't have any artifacts and stuff. So my students were getting access to information that even really wasn't available in, like, a magazine. I mean, even a periodical. They were getting real-life information about something happening right then, and it was just an email, something that everybody can do. So I've tried to build kind of some relationships with different people. There's somebody at Boston that I've emailed before saying, hey, you know, could I ask you questions about anything that might come up about the Boston Tea Party, the Boston Massacre, that I don't know. So, you know, just kind of trying to build those little networks, and, you know, I've never had anybody say, no, I'm not going to email you, no, I'm not going to answer your question, as long as it's a couple questions, it's not like 150 emails coming to them. Most people are very open to asking or to answering the questions, and I'm not an expert in every single thing I teach, so it's a great way of bringing in that expert to the classroom. Another way we've done this, when we talk about Western expansion, we use the Donner Party, great tool for eighth graders. We've got cannibalism, tragedy, you know, it's got everything. So, so we watched the PBS special from the American Experience on the Donner Party. David McCullough, one of my idols, he's the narrator, you know, this haunting voice describing everything that's happening. And so a lot of it revolves around transportation. The person that basically told them to take the shortcut to the Sierra Nevada Mountains, which obviously doesn't work, and it's stuck. It actually works eating each other, making them die. So at the beginning of the video, I'd say, okay, this half of the room, you're trying to prove that Lanesburg Hastings was guilty. Okay, this was a trial. You're trying to prove he's guilty. Write down all the evidence that you can find as you go through the video. Okay, this side, you're proving that he's not guilty. Same thing. Write down all the evidence. We're going to have a little debate at the end of the video. And they get all excited because they love, you know, debating each other about anything. So at the end of the video, we have a 2-minute debate for each side and then a 1-minute rebuttal. And I record it using an MP3 player. And I have contacted several of the people that were listed as historical references at the end of the video. The video is actually made in 1990, and unfortunately I found out like almost half the people were deceased already, which was really sad. I couldn't believe that. I mean, as I watched the video, I saw these people, and I found out that they passed away like 2 years or whatever. I'm like, man, you know, at least we got what we got on video, but what a loss. But so I contacted a bunch of people and said, hey, would you be willing to listen to a short audio file, no longer than 6 minutes, and then give us some feedback? And I got 2 emails back. One person does the Donner Party blog. Correct, the Donner Party blog. And then she's also written some books about the Donner Party. And then another person that does the Donner Party website who also has published some books. So I had 6 classes do this. I picked out the one that was the best debate that I thought between the two. Emailed it to these 2 experts. Within a couple of days, we had 5 pages back from each of them dissecting what the students said. I learned stuff about the Donner Party I never imagined. My students learned stuff about the Donner Party that they didn't know. Again, you know, when they knew that someone was listening to it besides Mr. Langhorst, you know, it became a much more important thing to them. And again, you could have written stuff down, sent it to them, but this was really neat because we recorded it, sent it to them, and, you know, maybe next year, they'll record their response and send it back to us and we'll listen to it. But again, bringing an expert into our classroom. Another thing, like, as far as bringing things into your classroom, the study paths. Occasionally, I'll put that up on the blog and the podcast as an example. 2 years ago at Christmas time, I had a guy from Spain email me, and he said, I love the study paths that you did on the American Revolution test, but I want you to know that you really emphasized the French contribution, and you didn't talk a lot about the Spanish contribution, but I helped you guys out too. And here's some of the books you should look at, and websites, and, you know, he included that. So then now that I teach that part, the Spanish get a little bit more credit because some guy in Spain. And my kids are like, what in the heck is somebody in Spain doing listening to our study guide? Nothing better to listen to. Just put it out there. They listen to it. Online assessment, this is the one thing that costs something. All the other stuff that I talked about you can do for free. I use a thing called Kia. There's also another one called QuizStar, which was free until this last year. I pay $50 a year to Kia to be able to do this, and I've used it for about 8 years now. But we usually do a project of some kind for each unit, and then we do an online assessment, which is like the content stuff. You can ask any type of question in Kia. Primarily mine are multiple choice type things. But what I love about it is you have complete control over everything. What your questions are. What, you know, you can randomize each question within the answer. You can randomize how they're ordered. I don't worry when we're in the lab. Kids are like happy because you have to like me. Now I'm just staring at the person next to you just to be able to figure out what they're doing. The kids get instant feedback if you want them to, so they can see what they got right, what they got wrong. They see their score. They don't have to ask me, you know, 3 days later if I've graded all the tests. And then I can use that data in any way that I want. I can look at each question. I can see each particular class, how they did on this particular question. I can compare classes. I can see the entire class. And then the thing that I really like is when they go in to take the Unit 3 test, right when they get up from Unit 3 test, they take the Unit 4 pre-test before we've gone over anything. And then at the end of that, they don't see the score. It just says, thanks for taking the test. But then that night or that afternoon, I can go in and see, okay, 20% of our students understand the Bill of Rights for the next unit. Or 80% of my students understand what the Fifth Amendment is. So I can then decide what I need to spend a lot of time on and what I don't need to spend a lot of time on. And it's instant. And I can give this information to my superintendent or my principal. You know, they have all the numbers and all that stuff. So I can show them pre-test, post-test. And then also, if I have a kid that's getting like 40-50% on all the pre-tests, and they're getting like 60% on the post-test, then you can come back and say, you're not even really gaining anything. How are you studying? You know, is there something we can do to help you? You know some of it, then you don't have to really make a game and things like that. You can also tag things so that when we create our unit tests, we put semester as a tag on some of them. So then at the end of the semester, all we do is go into create a new test. We want to put all the questions that have semester as a tag and create our test bank. And we literally make our semester test in like a minute and it's already created. So a lot of things you can do with it. Again, it's $50. I mean, I pay $50 every year for it. It's probably the best $50 I spend every year.
And it's Kia?
Kia, yeah. Q-U-I-A.
Our district has, like, our school has, like, a site license.
Yeah.
So many people got filled out.
So. And we do now. But, I mean, it's if you want to do it individually, it's free. So. Simulations. Look up elections. Amazing way for your students to basically run a campaign against each other or against the computer. It's from Cable in the Classroom. I'm kind of short on time here. I'm gone quite a bit this year because I'm the Missouri Teacher of the Year for 2007-2008. So I'm trying to kind of create some consistency because if I leave a PowerPoint for my sub, I mean, it'd be like if I was subbing for math. They could tell me to do all this stuff and I'd probably go through it in 5 minutes because I have no idea what I'm talking about. So if I give a PowerPoint to my sub and they don't really do like the extra story here or talk about this like I do, it doesn't really help the students when I'm gone. So you can use something called Cam Studio, which is like Camtasia. But Camtasia software is pretty expensive, like I think $300 or $400. Cam Studio is free, it's open source. So what that does is it creates a screencast. So you click on that button, you download it, then you click on the button, and then anything that you have on your screen is recorded as a video. And then if you have it hooked up to, if you have your computer hooked up to a USB mic, anything you say is also recorded to that. So at the end, you hit stop, and you have an AVI file. You can put it on a CD or a DVD, and then when you have your sub, you give it to your sub, and it's you talking for 25 minutes. Your height, you know, when you move your mouse and stuff over the map and stuff, it's exactly like you're there, except you're not there. And I was explaining to the kids the first time I did it, I was like, you know, hey, Tommy, I see, you know, you have to pay attention to that. And I was asking the kids to raise their hand. The kids are raising their hand or something. I did play it, except acting again, so So that's what, you know, and the other thing is, you know, if some of you guys are like tech people, if you're one of the people that, you know, everybody emails you at the end of the year, I can't remember how to set up my grade book, you know. Well, do it once and record it, and then send them the video, and go, here it is. But, you know, it shows you, all that kind of stuff. All right, so what do you do now? If you're a leader, be a leader in your district. You know, they give us all this great stuff. I haven't seen a district yet go, okay, we're going to match dollar for dollar everything we put in your room. We're also going to give you training. That just doesn't happen. So if you're someone who uses this stuff, share it with people. Local level, district level, state level. Ask your students how they like to learn, okay? That's how I've adapted the study paths, so that they can learn the way they like to get content. Build a technology dialogue with your administration. I convinced my administrators to do a podcast last year, okay? So that they can actually see how it works and understand the value of being able to talk to their audience, which for them was basically parents. And just remember that technology is just a tool. It's not a magic bullet. It's not going to solve every problem or every question you have. But the one thing that a lot of people ask me is, well, do you have any data? Do you have any data to show that this stuff works? We don't have state testing in social studies. That's a whole other session and podcast in itself. The only thing we do is a nationalized test we do in the fall. And so we compare how our ninth graders do from when they were in eighth grade. And our district is a fairly fluid district. We're in the top 10 in math in the state. And we just got the results back for this last year. And our eighth graders improved 9 percentage points, which was twice the improvement of any other subject area in the entire building. And I know there are other teachers who are working their tail off. So that's the only piece of data we have. But I have parents that say, my kids love history. They talk about history at home. You know, I love what you're doing in class. So, you know, I have enough data to be convinced that this stuff is getting kids engaged, they're excited, and then they're doing well on, you know, written tests or standardized tests or whatever. But this is a way to engage students and get them interested in history. And I've got kids going, man, I never knew that this stuff could be fun. You know, and that's why we're all doing this stuff. Everybody in this room has a passion for what we're teaching. So, you know, get kids hooked and play with some of this stuff. And if you have any questions, my blog is Speaking of History. So if you just do a Google search, it'll show up. It's officially at speakingofhistory.blogspot.com. And you can listen to podcasts as I'm doing stuff and email me. I'll try and email you back as soon as I can. But it's an amazing way to hook kids.
If you have any comments, you are more than welcome to go ahead and post on the blog, or you can email me at speakingofhistory@gmail.com. I'd love to hear your comments or any type of suggestions you might have about the presentation. As always, check out the blog. It's at www.speakingofhistory.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye. The Speaking of History podcast is produced by Eric Langhorst in Liberty, Missouri, under a Creative Commons license. Visit the website for show notes and links to material in the podcast at www.speakingofhistory.blogspot.com. The podcast is also available on iTunes. Please email all comments and questions to speakingofhistory@gmail.com. Background music for the intro is Z from James Underberg from PodSafe Audio. Thanks for listening.